Case number 07-5315, Anthony Summers, appellant versus Department of Justice. Mr. Lassar for the appellant, Mr. Valdez for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jim Lassar representing the appellant, Anthony Summers. This is a Freedom of Information Act case in which Mr. Summers filed suit to obtain records pertaining to Charles Beebe Rebozo, an associate of President Nixon's, who became implicated in the investigation into Watergate.
Is he also known as the Big Tuna?
I think that's correct. Or the Big Enchilada, one of those fishes.
Well, to make sure I had the right Beebe Rebozo in mind.
Yes. And Mr. Summers filed suit because the FBI did not promptly comply with his request. The FBI sought a stay under Open America, at the end of the period they had requested, the court granted that nunc pro tunc, and the FBI informed the court that it had released 128 pages to Mr. Summers. Subsequently, several times that many records were released. The preeminent issue before this court today is whether or not Mr. Summers substantially prevailed in the litigation and is thus eligible for an award of attorney's fees. Because of the passage at the end of 2007 of the Open Government Act of 2007, there is an issue as to whether or not that act's attorney fee provisions are retroactive. They clearly are. The Attorney Fee Act provisions restored the catalyst theory of attorney's fees in FOIA cases, which had been the law for almost 30 years prior to this court's decision in the oil and chemical and atomic workers case, which I'll refer to as the OCA decision.
And that's uncontested, right? Prospectively, that's uncontested.
Pardon?
That is uncontested prospectively.
It's uncontested
that it does it prospectively.
The only issue is whether it has that effect retrospectively.
Right.
In effect, the government argues that for a period of nearly three decades, from 1974 and until 2002, the catalyst theory was in effect, and sovereign immunity as to the award of fees had been waived for that period of time, and it is now waived from the end of 2007 forward, but there's a five-year gap at which the government could...
I thought it was common ground that it had been waived under certain conditions, and the question was what conditions apply to a particular period. Applying the OCA rule presents no sovereign immunity problem, right?
No, it presents no sovereign immunity problem. In effect, the government is arguing that there's a five-year period in which the catalyst theory does not apply. And in Landgraf, the Supreme Court set down the analysis for evaluating retroactivity claims, and it says that first you look at the intent, you look at the language of the statute to see whether or not there's an expression of intent regarding retroactivity, and secondly you look to see whether or not there are any impermissible retroactive effects on matters of substantive rights. In this case, the legislative history is very clear that Congress intended the statutes, the attorney fee provisions, to apply retroactively.
Let me ask you a question. Assuming that that's correct, forgetting whether it's, assuming that it's clear enough that the intention was to make the provision retroactive, does it follow without more that that also is a waiver of sovereign immunity, or is the standard for finding that intention somewhat more rigorous?
Well, the I think it follows that there is a waiver of sovereign immunity.
Not necessarily. If you find the one, you find the other.
I think that would be correct. But the in this case, this court ruled that there had been a waiver of sovereign immunity as to the 1974 amendments, and that they applied retroactively. That's the Cuneo v. Rumsfeld decision of this court, which was handed down, I think, in 1976. And all the Open Government Act amendments did was to restore what had existed before.
What is it exactly that makes you say that Congress clearly resolved it in favor of retroactivity?
Well, first, the Senate report.
We're already off the statutory language.
Yes, that's correct. The statutory language does not reflect anything one way or the other. The Senate report says that the bill amends the existing attorney fee provision to clarify that a complainant has substantially prevailed in the pursuit of the claim if the pursuit of the claim was a catalyst for the release of the records.
So what do you derive from the clarification? I mean, as an empirical matter, that would not be true vis-a-vis D.C. Circuit law, right?
Pardon?
As an empirical matter, that would not be true vis-a-vis D.C. Circuit law. The law is not being clarified, it's being changed.
No, I think that it is not being changed, because they are restoring the theory that had been in
a change which involves restoration of a prior rule.
Yes.
So it's a change, not a clarification. If it were to change, we wouldn't be here, right? At least we wouldn't.
Well, it's a change in the judicial interpretation. It's Congress, I think, viewed it as not a change in what they had intended. And that
operationally, the prior statute had come in the District of Columbia to mean something different from what Congress adopted in 2000.
As a result of the OCAW decision, yes.
Right.
Yes, that's.
So there was a rule, and Congress was changing it.
Yes, but the intent of Congress was to restore the rule that had been in place before.
We don't need the legislative history to see that.
No. Maybe it's more clear
so
in the House.
They haven't gotten any headway out of the reference to.
Well, let me go to the House report, because the House report says This section makes clear that the Buchanan decision does not apply to FOIA cases. That is clear and unequivocal. Buchanan, which is the basis for the OCAW decision,
does not apply.
Yes.
The same ambiguity does not apply going forward, or does not in the sense of eternally. Never applied.
Well, I think without a qualification, it means that it applies, that in any case it applies. If you wanted to qualify it and say it shall apply.
Will going forward.
Pardon?
So it will going forward.
And it applies by implication to cases that had been filed before but have not been finally resolved before enactment.
To see how we've gotten beyond the statutory language in terms of any real inference in favor of retroactivity.
Well, it seems to me obvious that if you wanted to qualify it in some way, you would say that it shall apply from now on or for the date of enactment of this law or something like that. Other than that, it applies to any pending case.
Well, you're creating a presumption in favor of retroactivity.
Pardon?
You're effectively creating a presumption in favor of retroactivity.
You're saying if it's unclear, which it is, then it's retroactive.
Well, to me, it's clear that what Congress is saying is that this applies across the board.
If we say that it's clear, when what the Congress, or at least the legislative history, says, when that says this applies, and if we take that to mean it applies both retroactively and prospectively.
It says it applies in FOIA cases,
yeah.
Right? If a FOIA case is pending, it's a FOIA case. How do you get around that? It seems to me that
this is a different argument, I guess. This is, at least than we've been discussing, this is to say that it applies, you're invoking, as you do in your brief, I think, the rule that the court applies the law as of the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
But what the House report says, to make clear that the Buchanan decision does not apply to FOIA cases. That seems to me to be about as straight and unequivocal as you can state it. If there's a FOIA case, Buchanan does not apply. And that means that the fee provision is retroactive. And if it's retroactive, the catalyst theory applies. And under the catalyst theory, it's undisputed that under the catalyst theory, if the catalyst theory does apply, my client is entitled to an award of fees.
No, I think that is disputed.
Pardon?
I think that is disputed. It's undisputed that he'd be eligible.
I'm sorry. You're correct. It's undisputed that he would be eligible if the catalyst theory applies. That's correct.
So if we agree with you, what do we do about entitlement? You've argued that you're eligible, but the district judge didn't address entitlement. Will we have to remand?
Well, it's before the court de novo. However, entitlement is an abuse of discretion standard. I think in that case, the court would probably want to remand it for a further development of the reasons. But I would certainly think that the record is sufficient on appeal for the court to be able to decide it de novo. Pardon?
I think you're right in that respect.
Yeah. I think that...
documentary case.
Yes. I think that the evidence is quite clear that he is entitled. He's a member of... a favored class of requesters, journalists and reporters and scholars who are seeking information on a matter of public interest.
The only joint issue is whether the relief was in any way enforced by the court, right? Isn't that the only contested
issue? Is in any way what?
Enforced by the court. Isn't that the only contested issue? You say, well, they give an order which was had the implicit sanction of contempt behind it, and the government says, but the order didn't require
Okay, we're on a different issue now. That's not entitlement. That's the question of eligibility under the alternative theory of eligibility.
Oh,
which,
I'm sorry. Okay,
yeah.
You're right.
Which is that under the OCAW line of decisions,
he's entitled anyway.
He's entitled anyway. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You cited a House report, and I take it it's the House report that appears at page 5 of your reply brief.
I would assume that's correct. Yes.
I noticed that it's dated 2008. I don't know exactly what day in 2008.
That must be a typo. I can't imagine. It has to be 2007.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's the Senate report that you cite is 110th Congress first session, and this is 110th Congress second session.
Yeah.
Well, that's not. I mean, the one.
Well, the bill was signed into law December 31st, 2007. Oh, so
right.
2008 has to be wrong.
Then first, second session has.
Well,
to be
Well, I was
wrong
wondering
too.
If it might be post-enactment legislative history.
No.
You're sure?
I'm pretty certain of that.
Well, the text of it seems to be. You can double check, but it seems to deal with a bill that hasn't yet passed. The quoted portion of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Lewis, okay. Well over time.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And we'll hear from the government here.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Daryl Valdez. And I'm with the United States Attorney's Office, and I represent the appellee in this matter. I think appellant's argument makes it clear that what he wants to do is he wants to go back for the last 6 years and move for attorney's fees on every single case, every single FOIA case that he had and that he lost. And he wants attorney's
fees. Well, he doesn't.
Well, according to his argument.
He could win here without being entitled to reopen.
Well, the problem is that again,
of
I don't know how that
closed
on
cases.
Case.
Well, I think what it makes clear is that that is the logical extension of what the plaintiff is, or what the appellant is arguing here. Your Honors, as Your Honors have noted,
extension is the controlling word in that, rather than logical.
I understand
the
that. Yes,
controlling
sure.
Part of that statement.
Your Honor, as this court has noted in Landsgraf, the Supreme Court used these terms so many times that they had to make it absolutely clear that the Congress had to expressly prescribe the statute's reach, whether Congress has made clear its intent the statutes to be applied retroactively. By language so clear and positive as to leave no room to doubt that it was the intention of the legislature, unless their language requires the result of retroactive effect. And
then it turned out in later cases didn't.
I'm sorry?
Turned out in later cases that you could look at legislative history, which you really wouldn't do if the statute were clear.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that there's no case law where legislative history was used to waive sovereign immunity. Only
were
with
you on sovereign immunity with those quotations or on retroactivity?
I'm sorry, I was on retroactivity with those quotations. Oh. Yes, Your Honor. And I believe, Your Honor, that in the cases that were cited by the appellant in this case, every case, with the exception of, Cuneo even doesn't even hurt us, because Cuneo says that you apply the law at the time that the action was pending. And our case was long since resolved. The merits of our case was long since resolved. And we were way on appeal and had filed our motion for summary affirmance before the statute was amended. So clearly, the government had already acted in reliance upon what the law was at the time. Going back to the legislative intent, Your Honor, the Nothing in that legislative history says when. If it says that shows that the House report says that Buchanan does not apply, it does not say as of when. And it does not say never apply. It just says does not. That means, that almost sounds like as of this point forward, it does not cover this situation. Neither of those legislative histories say anything with respect to retroactivity. And however, what appellant wants to do is they want to turn Landsgraf on its head and say, well, because they kind of hinted at it, or there's something that we can turn around and make it sound like it, that's good enough. But that doesn't rise to the level of the clear intent that Landsgraf requires. And then going to the skipping over the language of the statute and going to a single statement that, again, does not mention retroactivity at all as the basis for a kind of congressional intent is not sufficient under Landsgraf.
Well, you use some legislative history yourself. Well, it's only fair. I mean, having been brought against you, you're entitled to bring it up. But I guess you accept the proposition that in writing an opinion, we would have to look at legislative history.
Under Landsgraf, yes, Your Honor. I would say yes, you do.
Okay. And your bit of legislative history is the testimony that this would improve the incentives for government agencies.
Well, our argument with respect to legislative history is that there's nothing to support the appellant, and that the one statement that we did cite cuts our way, and it clearly shows that there really wasn't an expression by Congress as a clear intent as to whether it is retroactive or not, they can cut both ways.
Nate, the structure of your argument is, as you highlighted in your quotations, is that the presumption is in your favor.
Correct.
So you don't need legislative history to bolster it. You need only to unhorse Mr. Lazar's legislative history.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. May I address a same thing?
If his horse has come forward, you have to, or if his rider has come forward, you have to unhorse it, right?
Well,
yes, Mr. Lazarus, yes.
Yeah.
You don't have to feed his horse too, though.
That's right. That's right, Your Honor. I don't think that we have to say, oh, well, that Mr. Lazarus made his point, and therefore we have to counter it. We can say not only has he not made his point, Your Honor, but there's language that goes cuts the other way as well. So it really is no clear intent. I'm sorry, if I may address a question that Judge Brown asked with respect to the ruling on the entitlement issue, Your Honor, is that if you read the district court judge's decision, he denied the motion for reconsideration and upheld the magistrate judge's opinion, which he described as a well-reasoned and thoroughly explained ruling. And because he denied the reconsideration, it is our stand, Your Honor, that the magistrate judge's decision with respect to entitlement still stands, and that this court's review on that issue is for abuse of discretion. I don't know if there's no more other questions, I would submit to the court and ask that the court affirm.
Is that in your brief, that point about the standard of review?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It's the very beginning of our argument with respect to the merits. Yes.
I'm sorry. Entitlement is the second step, right?
Correct.
Okay, and
eligibility is the first step.
Right. And I would understand that entitlement, the criteria for entitlement are exactly the same whether or not we have, whichever the ground of eligibility, if he gets over that obstacle.
Well, then you have the four factors under the entitlement.
Automatically into the four factors.
Yes, which the magistrate judge found that the government satisfied factor number one and number four. Number four being the reasonableness of the government's position, basically that by not challenging the government's, the rulings below in favor of the government, plaintiff or the appellant kind of waived that argument and can't argue against it. And the first one was that the first factor was that whether it was likely to add to the fund of information that citizens may use in making vital political choices, the magistrate judge held that because the purpose of FOIA was to shed light on an agency's actions, that disclosing information about private citizens that is accumulated in various governmental files, but reveals little or nothing about an agency's own conduct, does not meet that standard.
The three names that came out are all private citizens.
Yes, they were.
Mr. Valdez, is it your position that the standard for finding, the standard of clarity required of the legislature to make this statute retroactive is as high as the standard required to waive sovereign immunity?
Your Honor, because the decision in Landsgraf, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be avoiding, but because the decision in Landsgraf was based on sovereign immunity, I would argue yes.
Landsgraf, though, has, I'm not sure whether it's facially addressed this way, but it certainly has been taken as being applicable to questions of retroactivity that involve no issue of sovereign immunity.
I believe that it could go both ways, Your Honor. That is correct. But when the issue of sovereign immunity is intertwined in with the decision, then the answer is yes, and in this case it is.
So to resolve the one is to resolve the both.
Correct.
There aren't different shades of clarity.
I'm sorry?
There are not different shades of clarity.
I would agree with that.
The human mind has a hard time dealing with multiple shades of clarity.
Well, it's like burdens of proof, wouldn't it? Be like
Mr.
a preponderance versus beyond a reasonable doubt. By a preponderance, it's retroactive, but it's not retroactive against the government unless it's beyond a reasonable
doubt.
That's what it means, yes. Well, yeah, I mean, it's not, doesn't defy human cognition, is the point, or at least legal cognition.
You and I can talk, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, you and I will just talk. Mr. Lazar,
oh, you're still here.
Says that that if the catalyst theory applies, he is eligible. And so I'm wondering what your response is to that.
My response actually would be that he's not, Your Honor. That he is not. That first of all, no judicial order, no consent decree. And even the written, the agreement in this case, if you read it carefully, it's not an enforceable against the government, because all the government agreed to was look further than they were obligated to see if these people are dead. If we deem that if we are satisfied that they are dead, we would release their names, and then the plaintiff could then dismiss. So really, if we didn't search far enough for his satisfaction, or if we didn't deem reasonably, there was nothing for him to enforce against us other than we just keep going forward with the appellate case that was going on at the time. And then secondly, Your Honor, we also would argue that the claim by the appellant is insubstantial, which is also a requirement under that theory, is that the release of the three names on one piece of paper out of the hundreds of pages really was not substantial enough to meet that theory.
You said, I think, that the government agreed to search beyond what its duty to search was. How do we know that it was beyond what its duty to search was?
Well, because the lower court already determined that we had searched within to the extent of our duty.
But he was appealing, right? So he at least theorized that we might say it was a broader duty to search than the court had found.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. However, since that appeal did not go forward, that's not an argument here that he could make.
In terms of analyzing under the catalyst theory, plausible argument could be made that the threat of the appeal was a catalyst producing the three names. No.
The answer to that, though, is that that's not what was substantially prevailed under the statute. The catalyst theory requires that it be an enforceable written agreement. So there was at the agreement itself, and was that enforceable?
Not the catalyst theory. You're mixing theories, right? Aren't you?
No, Your Honor. That's how it's defined under the statute, under the Open Government Act of 2007. It requires when it talks about what is substantially prevailed. It sets out. That it's one, a judicial order or enforceable written agreement or consent decree, or two, a voluntary or unilateral change in position by the agency if the complainant's claim is not insubstantial. Now, if he's going under the second prong, that it was a change by us, again, he has to meet the not insubstantial requirement, which is what we argued that he could not meet. And under the first prong, it's argument that he couldn't. Okay.
Despite the settlement on the merits, we would have to resolve whether the claim for further searching was or was not insubstantial.
But no, whether the providing the three names was not insubstantial, or whether the agreement to search further was not an enforceable.
Your change of position.
Correct.
Which he had catalyzed was substantial or not.
Correct, yeah, yes.
Okay, I think we, well, any further questions? All right, thank you, Mr.
Valdez. Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, Mr. Lazar, you were way over time, as was Mr. Valdez, I would give you a minute if you really are responding to what he's saying.
Yes, I am, because I want to correct a misstatement of fact. He responded in response to a question by Judge Williams as to whether or not the three names released were private citizens, and he said, yes, they were. That is not true. Two of them are government officials. One of them was an FBI supervisor. The other was the agent in the New York office who relayed the information, which went personally to J. Edgar Hoover. That information is not insubstantial because it reveals, and the third name is.
It reveals what the government was up to.
It reveals what the government was up to and who it was up to it with. Yes.
Okay, can I just go back to